I'm not leaving until we get 100% social housing.
Liters of jet fuel was discharged into Lemon Creek and entered the Slocan River and the Kootenay River, killing fish and harming aquatic ecology. That was on July 26, 2013.
I can't stop thinking about how violent Abdi's life and the lives of many marginalized people was on a daily basis.
Welcome to Groundwire, community radio news.
This episode of Groundwire was produced by volunteers at Kootenay Cooperative Radio on Sinaixt Traditional Territory in Nelson, B.C.
In this episode,
Groundwire speaks with one of the organizers of the recently occupied Garden City Camp at 58 Hastings Street in Vancouver.
And community members in Montreal demonstrate against police brutality after Abdirahman Abdi dies following injuries sustained during an arrest in Ottawa.
But first, here are the headlines.
3 years after a tanker truck spilled 33,000 liters of jet fuel into Lemon Creek in the Slocan Valley, federal prosecutors have laid 8 charges against the trucking company Executive Flight Center, as well as its driver and the BC government. The fuel spill into Lemon Creek polluted the Slocan River, resulting in an evacuation and orders not to drink the water for several days. Slocan Valley resident Marilyn Burgoon initially filed charges in a private prosecution, and then in January of this year, the government decided to take over the prosecution, filing for 2 counts of depositing a deleterious substance in water frequented by fish under the Fisheries Act and 6 counts of introducing waste into a stream causing pollution under the Environmental Management Act. Bruce Edson from Kootenay Co-op Radio spoke with Marilyn Burgoon about the spill.
33,000 liters of jet fuel was discharged into Lemon Creek and entered the Slocan River and the Kootenay River, killing fish and harming aquatic ecology. That was on July 26, 2013, when I fully expected that charges would be laid. For years, they weren't laid, so I took it upon myself to do the rare thing of filing a private prosecution. And at the time I filed it, that I had to go through a preliminary hearing with a judge to prove that it wasn't a frivolous case, that I did have the facts that under the Fisheries Act, deleterious material had been put into the creek. So from that point on, we had expected the public prosecutor to take over, since that is their job. It's a public interest. Thousands of people were evacuated from their homes, so it was quite a very public interest case. West Coast Environmental Law, who's been supporting me in this case, had on their website thousands of letters sent to the Minister of Justice to get the federal prosecutor to take over. And this happened in January here. The public prosecutor decided to take over and intervene in the case.
The court case is set for September 13th.
Up next,
CKUT's Geneva Gleason brings us an update on the Lakatos family, who are facing deportation.
On July 16th, the temporary residence permit for 2 Hungarian Roma women of the Lakatos family expired, leaving the women to face deportation. They were summoned to a meeting at the Canadian Border Services Agency, the CBSA, on Thursday, July 28th, during which the CBSA refused their application for permanent residence on humanitarian grounds. Activist group Solidarity Across Borders organized a support rally while the Lakatos women awaited the decision. Community members from several countries of origin gathered in front of the agency to show their support. The Lakatos family have lived in Canada since June 2011 and have faced deportation since their refugee demand was denied in April 2015. In March 2016, the father and brother of the family were deported to Hungary, where they continued to face the racial discrimination and persecution that forced the family to flee Hungary in 2011. After the women exited the meeting, Gilda Lakatos, who is 17 years old, told the press that she is exhausted and that after 5 years she is still not able to lead a normal life due to the government's treatment of her family. Solidarity Across Borders suggests that community members who want to get involved call or email the MP in their riding and ask them to contact Minister of Immigration John McCallum in support of the Lakatos family. For more information, visit solidarityacrossborders.org or Roman Ipe, romanipe.wordpress.com.
July 18th was World Listening Day, an annual global event that celebrates the ecology of the world's acoustic environments. Check out the webpage of the World Listening Projects at worldlisteningproject.org to hear thousands of sound design projects uploaded from all over the world. This piece was recorded in Egypt by Bassam Yakut of the Oystat Sound Design Group, an international body of sound designers and sound artists who primarily work in theater and the performing arts.
That's it for the headlines. We'll be right back after this.
Now it's time for our feature stories.
About 150 people have pitched tents in an empty lot at 58 Hastings Street in Vancouver. Gunarji O'Sullivan spoke with Simona, one of the camp organizers, who plans to stay until the city commits to building on that site social housing at pension and welfare rates.
What we're looking for is for this to be 100% self-contained units. That doesn't mean like PHS that you have to phone home every 3 days. You know, it's where you have your own key, your own door, your own friends can come over and visit. I think the harshest thing is welfare day, which most of us get our most money then, they're saying, oh, you can't have any friends in there. So they're either saying, you have to go outside and risk being jumped, mm-hmm. robbed,
yeah.
arrested.
Yeah.
You know, anything can happen. Or sit in your room by yourself and get high, which who supports? Not
yeah.
us, you know.
Yeah.
Vancouver, and especially the downtown east side, lacks adequate affordable housing and has a huge problem with homelessness. Mayor Gregor Robertson campaigned on a promise to eliminate street homelessness by 2015, but the 2016 stats for homelessness are the worst in a decade. Garden City started on July 9th when more than 200 people attended a day of action for housing justice called by the Vancouver Area Network of Drug Users and the International League of People Struggle. On that day, a number of people pitched tents in a vacant lot at 58 West Hastings Street. The number of residents living in Garden City has now grown to about 150 people in 74 tents.
What we did is we looked at all the different tent cities we had, like the Oppenheimer, the Olympics, the Woodward, you know, mm-hmm. Victoria. That's why all of our tents are 3 feet apart. Because we know that the firemen will make it or break it. You know, keep them happy and jump through their hoops and we're here, right? Because I'm not leaving until we get 100% social housing.
Good.
Self-contained units. You know, like, when you get supportive housing, it's awesome for some people. You know, some people need that. But other people don't. And I feel like I'm 9 all over again when I go out and they're like, phone home every 3 days. For real? Like, 3 days? Oh, that's a blink of an eye sometimes, you know, especially down here, like...
This isn't the first time the property has hosted a tent city. In 2010, during the Winter Olympics, which were held in Vancouver, 58 West Hastings was the site of the Olympic Tent Village. In 2015, the City of Vancouver designated 58 West Hastings as the future home of one of the Vancouver Affordable Housing Agency's 7 sites of affordable housing. However, the current plans indicate that only 15% of any units built will rent at income assistance rates, while 31% will be affordable market rates and 58% will be subsidized rents. So there is sure to be further displacement of low-income people in the neighborhood and a further loss of affordable housing. Simona and other Garden City organizers are meeting with Mayor Robertson this week to discuss the property. When Gennargi asked if the Garden City residents needed anything, Simona said,
"We need donations."
Yeah. And where are you located?
58 West Hastings.
Do you have e-transfer?
We have a GoFundMe account. Uh-huh. And it's VancouverTentCity.wordpress.com.
Okay. Thank you so much joining us today, and we wish you the best of luck.
Thanks to Gennargi O'Sullivan from CFRO, Vancouver Co-op Radio, for that interview. On July 24th, Abdurrahman Abdi was beaten by Ottawa police and later died of his injuries. Jessica Zarek from CKUT Radio reports on a community demonstration that took place in Montreal later that week.
On July 28th, community members in Montreal took part in a demonstration to denounce police violence and a vigil to honor the life of Abdurrahman Abdi, a 37-year-old black Somali man who died after sustaining injuries at the hands of police during an arrest in Ottawa. This demonstration was co-organized by members of Montréal Noir and Justice for the Victims of Police Killings Coalition. Idil spoke at the demonstration.
We flee violence only to be met with a different kind of violence. Abdurrahman came to Canada for the promise of safety and to work towards a better life. The fact that Abdi did not die amidst the violence and insecurity of Somalia, but in the supposed safety and refuge of Canada, is a tragic irony. One of the most heartbreaking aspects of Abdi's story has to do with his mental illness. His family have said that he was dealing with an unspecified mental illness, and those in the community also knew that he was afflicted with an illness. The fact that it was unspecified does not surprise me. Many people in our community deal with mental illness but do not have the access to resources to be able to get the necessary help. There is an understanding, often unspoken, of the trauma that exists in our community. Those back home and those in the diaspora are dealing with unimaginable trauma and pain from decades of war, displacement, loss, and poverty. Did the police officers recognize this trauma? Did they see his mental illness? Or did they see a monster, a deviant, a thug? I have no interest in discussing what may have led to the call that brought police to Hindenburg on Sunday, because whatever Abdi did not deserve that kind of malicious, hateful, violent response. In that moment, Abdurrahman was not afforded his humanity, the same humanity that would likely be afforded to his white counterpart. He was seen as an expendable deviant. I think it's important that we also expand our understanding of violence. While killings of this nature are examples of violence in its most extreme form, I can't stop thinking about how violent Abdi's life and the lives of many marginalized people was on a daily basis. His exclusion from the comforts of society, how he suffered emotionally and mentally. Abdurrahman's story highlights how we love to boast about how we are a country of immigrants, but how we are not too concerned about the welfare and quality of life of immigrants.
Marion Lopez spoke personally as a mother of a black autistic boy.
Before I share, I want to denounce the way the media is using Abdurrahman's Abdi's unspecified mental health as a strategy to avoid talking about how race played a role in his death. They can't justify police violence by blaming it on disability or mental illness. And we can't allow the media or the police to use one type of discrimination to excuse another. By focusing on Abdi's mental capacity, we are concealing structural racism under the cloak of ableism. We cannot forget the obvious. It is not reasonable to beat an unarmed man to death. So I ask you folks out here this evening, what do Andrew Loku, Abdirahman Abdi, Freddie Gray, Tanisha Anderson all have in common? Most of you will say that they were all black and that they were all victims of police violence. But there is one more thing that they have in common. They all suffered from mental health issues or disabilities. Racial profiling continues to be a persistent issue in policing. So what happens when someone is both black and disabled? People with disabilities or with mental health issues may struggle to comply with police orders, panic, and appear to be resisting, which increases chances that police will rely on the excessive use of force. Finally, I want to finish just by saying that we need to open spaces for disabled, neurodivergent people of color to tell their experiences from their perspectives. This is something I will fight for the rest of my life because it's personal. I have a 7-year-old beautiful black boy who is on the autism spectrum. Racial bias and ableism increase chances that he will be confronted with police in the future. This haunts me all the time, and it's the reality I deal with every day as a mother. I imagine all the things that can go wrong in a world that fears my son's skin color and doesn't understand the way his brain works. So please, folks, let's stay woke.
Now it's time for our community radio report.
The recent dismissal of Commissioner Raj Shon from the CRTC suggests a larger issue of systemic racism within the CRTC and also across the media landscape in Canada. Ome Samarahemtula of Groundwire interviewed two representatives from the Community Media Advocacy Centre about the dismissal and what they see as some of its larger implications.
Last month, at the recommendation of the Minister of Canadian Heritage, Melanie Joly, the Governor General and Council terminated Raj Shon's position as CRTC Commissioner for Ontario. The Canadian Radio Television and Telecommunications Commissions, the CRTC, appoints commissioners to represent each region in Canada for a term of 5 years. Commissioner Shon was only in his third year at the CRTC when he was dismissed. Christiana Clemens is the president of the Community Media Advocacy Centre and has spent 2 decades working in community radio, most recently as the station manager of CFRC Community Radio in Kingston, Ontario.
That's to say that in almost 50 years that we've had the Canadian Radio, Television and Telecommunications Commission, only 2 of 103 individuals that have been appointed are identified as visible minorities. Now, that's the terminology used by the government to identify people of color, but according to Statistics Canada, over 19% of our population belong to visible minorities, and that's anticipated to go up to 23% by next year. So clearly there's an enormous deficit and lack of representation of people of color on the commission historically and to the present day. The commission can have up to 13 commissioners on it, and Raj was the only quote-unquote visible minority on the commission out of 8 commissioners that were serving.
The reasons for Commissioner Shon's dismissal have not been publicly disclosed, but it is widely believed that they are related to the ongoing legal action between Shon and CRTC Chairman Jean-Pierre Blaise. In April 2015, Schoen applied for a judicial review of Chairman Blay's decision to accept the results of a report that concluded Schoen's behavior toward a CRTC employee constituted harassment. Schoen's subsequent dismissal came only days after the first public hearing in this judicial review, at which Presiding Justice Russell Zinn commented it was troubling that Chairman Blaze was both a witness in the harassment investigation and the vigil who accepted the report's findings. But most troubling to this case are documents filed in Schoen's legal challenge to his dismissal that allege a toxic environment of overt racism within the CRTC, enforced through a culture of fear and intimidation. Schoen argues that a racist double standard was used in handling harassment allegations against him, as compared to a white commissioner who he alleges referred to him as a spoiled rich brown kid who probably grew up with servants, requested to change hotels on commission-sanctioned travel because there were too many black people, and complained that it smelled like curry in her office after meeting with ethnic broadcasters. The CRTC is a public authority that regulates broadcasting and telecommunications on behalf of all Canadians, including those impacted by systemic and overt racism. The dismissal of Commissioner Schoen points to a context lacking equitable representation of people of color on the commission, and a historic ongoing lack of equitable access for and representation of racialized communities within Canada's media and telecommunications landscapes. Laith Marouf is a consultant at the Canadian Media Advocacy Centre and a longtime multimedia producer who is currently serving as the coordinator of Independent Community Television Montreal.
Representation and equity in media in general in Canada is very lacking. If you take a quick look, obviously, on the private and the public broadcasters, there is very little productions that are specifically dealing with issues of communities that are seeking equity and representation, be it visible minorities, linguistic minorities, and indigenous nations. On the other hand, where it's expected that these communities receive equity, or it's more expected, I guess, is in the community media sector. And unfortunately, there also there is huge failures in giving representation and equity. So, well, on the ground, the community radio stations and community TV stations are mainly staffed, again, with white staffings, and their boards are also mainly white. So where does communities seeking equity find it in the Canadian media spectrum? Broadcasting is hard to pinpoint any place.
Even though Commissioner Schoen comes from a corporate media background, many believe he was a strong ally and that his dismissal is a great loss for community media. The CRTC has already started a search to replace Commissioner Schoen in Ontario, in spite of the fact that the court proceedings related to Schoen's harassment and dismissal cases are not yet concluded, and no public reason was given for his dismissal.
I met my love, Woolwich Pier, beneath the big crane standing in all the love felt for her, it passed all understanding. Took her sailing on the river flow, sweet river flow. London town was mine to give her, sweet Thames flow softly. Made the Thames into a crown, flow, sweet river flow. Made a brooch of silver town, sweet Thames flow softly.
Here at Groundwire, we want to remind you to check out World Listening Day coverage at theworldlisteningproject.org. You can hear thousands of sound design projects uploaded from all over the world. This is a piece called Tetu 2, which was recorded in Addis Ababa, Ethiopia. That's it for this edition of Groundware, produced by volunteers at Kootenai Cooperative Radio on Sinaik's traditional territory in Nelson, BC. Music this week was by James Keelahan, Quator Bozzini, and the World Listening Project.
Headlines this week were written by Geneva Gleason, Carly Forbes, and Catherine Fisher, with files from Bruce Edson.
We also thank Gunnar G. O'Sullivan, Omay Samara Hamtula, Jessica Zarek, and Carly Forbes.
I'm Yvette Jansen.
And I'm Catherine Fisher.
Tune in again to hear Groundwire on your local community radio station. Download at groundwirenews.ca or podcast at rabble.ca.